The interrogation of Ramzi Youssef continued as he was flown from Pakistan to the United States. What follows is the FBI's report on that interrogation, which is listed under Youssef's real name. Interview of Abdul Basit Mahmoud Abdul Karim on February 7th and 8th, 1995. On February 7th and 8th, 1995, Abdul Basit Mahmoud Abdul Karim, also known as Ramzi Ahmed Youssef, hereafter referred to as Basit, was interviewed aboard an aircraft en route from Islamabad, Pakistan, to the United States. Basit advised that he could fluently speak, read, and understand the English language. He was advised of the official identities of the interviewing agents and was reminded that he was under arrest for offenses concerning the bombing of the World Trade Center in New York City. He was thereafter advised of his constitutional rights by reading them and having them read to him. Due to Basit's request, notes were not taken in his presence, but were summarized during breaks in the interview. In 1992, he traveled to New York City from Pakistan. Upon entry at John F. Kennedy International Airport in New York, Basit utilized an Iraqi passport in the name of Ramzi Ahmed Youssef. Basit explained that he had purchased the Iraqi passport for $100 in Peshawar, Pakistan. He noted Peshawar is the easiest place to purchase Iraqi passports, and further explained that these are genuine documents stolen by Iraqi rebels who raid passport offices in northern Iraq. When presenting the Iraqi passport to U.S. immigration officials, Basit requested political asylum and was processed and released. Basit advised that in the fall of 1994, after the World Trade Center attack, he had learned through various press accounts that President Clinton would be traveling to Manila in November. Basit claimed that he traveled to Manila a few days prior to the president's arrival. Once in Manila, Basit determined the president's planned itinerary through reported press accounts. Basit related that he thereafter traveled to each of the sites which the president would visit in order to survey them for opportunities to attempt an assassination. He noted that the level of security which he observed at each of these sites was very high. Basit advised that the assassination attempt on Clinton was never carried out due to the observations of high security and his lack of time needed to plan and organize such an attempt. The second option which Basit considered was a bombing attack of the presidential motorcade while the motorcade was en route between sites in Manila. Basit indicated that he considered placing an improvised explosive device in a location along the motorcade route, designed to disable the lead car in the motorcade. He explained that by disabling the lead vehicle, the entire motorcade would be brought to a stop, enabling an explosive or poisonous gas attack on the presidential limousine. He related that he had considered using the chemical agent phosgene in the attack on the limousine and noted that he had the technical ability to readily manufacture that substance. According to Basit, the phosgene, in a liquid form, could be placed in a metal container which could then be opened with a charge of explosive, rapidly dispensing the substance as gas. He related that his associates had also been interested in the Pope, but denied that the Pope was an assassination target. Basit attributed religious articles and photographs of the Pope found in his apartment in Manila to the general interest of his associates. He spoke of an incident which occurred in his Manila apartment in early January 1995, which had been reported in the media as a fire. He related that he had been demonstrating the burning of a mixture of chemicals when smoke produced by the burning began to fill the apartment. He was then questioned as to certain materials found in the Manila apartment, which appeared to refer to U.S. airline flights. He noted that if the incident at the Manila apartment had not occurred, there would have been several airline bombings within 2 weeks of that time, known as the Manila air plot. Basit asked the interviewing agents whether the agents knew how the person who had been arrested in the Philippines and who had subsequently escaped had affected the escape. In discussing this individual, Basit acknowledged that this individual was known as Wali Khan Amin Shah, who was an early associate of bin Laden's. Following Basit's descriptions of Wali as strong and intelligent, Basit was questioned as to whether Basit had been acting under the direction of Wali Shah. Basit would not further elaborate on that issue. When questioned regarding a business card in the name of Mohammed Khalifa, bin Laden's brother-in-law, Jamal Khalifa, found in Basit's apartment in the Philippines, Basit stated that he did not personally know Khalifa, but that Khalifa's business card had been given to him by Wali Shah as a contact in the event Basit needed aid. Basit acknowledged that he was familiar with the name Osama bin Laden and knew him to be a relative of Khalifa's, but would not further elaborate. Ragida Dirgam of the Arabic newspaper Al-Hayat interviewed Ramzi Ahmed Youssef in a Manhattan jail after his arrest in 1995, the only time that he has spoken to a reporter. Excerpts of that interview follow. My real name is Abdel Basit Al-Balushi. I was born in Kuwait. The family is from Pakistan, but I also descend from Palestinian origins. I carry a Pakistani passport. I am Palestinian on my mother's side. My grandmother is Palestinian. A part of my family is in Pakistan, a part in Kuwait, and I have some relatives in Palestine. I have no connection with Iraq or with other governmental circles. The Iraqi people must not pay for the mistakes made by Saddam. I only support the Liberation Army, which declared its responsibility for the World Trade Center bombing. It is an international movement concerned with affairs of the world's Islamic armed movements. I am not the brains. The movement has groups and military divisions, each of which takes care of Islamic movement's affairs in various countries. I support this movement's objectives, which are to pressure the U.S. administration by carrying out operations against U.S. targets so this administration will stop its aid for Israel. I believe that this movement, and Palestinians generally, is entitled to strike U.S. targets because the United States is a partner in the crimes committed in Palestine, considering that it finances these crimes and supports them with weapons. The movement is also entitled because this money is taken from taxes paid by Americans. Logically and legally, this makes the American people responsible for all the killing, settlement, torture, and imprisonment crimes to which the Palestinian people are subjected. It is no excuse that the American people do not know where their federal tax money goes. One of the Liberation Army's goals has been to aid members of Egypt's Islamic group and jihad group, Palestine's Hamas, Islamic Resistance Movement, and Islamic Jihad, and Algeria's FIS, Islamic Salvation Front, and armed Islamic movements. The Liberation Army movement was about to embark on retaliatory acts in Saudi Arabia in wake of the 1994 arrest of Sheikh Salman Fahd al-Auda and Sheikh Safar al-Hawali. The fatwas and fates of the militant Saudi clerics Salman al-Auda and Safar al-Hawali would have an important impact on bin Laden and al-Qaeda. Al-Auda and al-Hawali were among the first Saudi clerics to issue cassette tapes of sermons against the U.S. presence in Saudi Arabia in 1991. Their subsequent arrests in September 1994 would have a radicalizing effect on bin Laden. Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer. He said that Sheikh Salman Auda is my ideal personality, a savior who was the first person to demand the withdrawal of U.S. troops from Saudi Arabia. And Salman al-Auda wrote some pamphlets for al-Qaeda, but those pamphlets were not distributed in his name. They were on jihad. Abu Jandal, who became bin Laden's chief bodyguard in 1998. Osama bin Laden respected Sheikh Salman al-Auda and Sheikh Safar al-Hawali. The Saudi government had responded by arresting all of these sheikhs and imprisoning them. And after he had learned that the government stifled all sources of the truth, Sheikh Osama bin Laden was forced to make himself heard. He said, "By God, if the Saudi government did not arrest the reform movement sheikhs and preachers, I would not have raised my voice or spoken. When the Saudi sheikhs were arrested and when the government silenced all words of truth that were said against them, I was forced to speak and take this action. My words, of course, differ from that of others. Some speak through discussion, but I do it well with the rifle." Ibrahim al-Sanusi, assistant to Hassan al-Turabi, the de facto leader of Sudan in the mid-90s. After the invasion of Iraq, Desert Storm, some ulema clergy started to speak about this U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq and the U.S. bases in Saudi Arabia, especially Saif al-Hawali and Sulaiman al-Awda, the influential militant Saudi clerics. These are the teachers of Osama bin Laden. They inspired his ideas and they gave him the arguments. At this time, bin Laden started his interest of being a politician, and he began to speak about what should happen in Saudi Arabia and the reformation that you have to have there. It was maybe 93, 94 when he began to speak about that. Before that, he was just a contractor. But now these speeches of al-Hawali, they began to come all over the Arabic countries in cassettes, criticizing the Saudi royal family. And this atmosphere gave Osama bin Laden here in the Sudan the chance to speak. During this time, the youth from all Arabic countries began to come to Sudan. Libyans, Saudis, Emirates. They gave bin Laden the title of Sheikh Osama. Quickly, he became very popular. They like him and they listen to him, and especially as he has money. He can solve their problems. And when bin Laden's activities became a nuisance to Saudis, Saudi Arabia announced that they have renounced his nationality and said that he is no longer Saudi and no longer has a passport. That wasn't a problem for him because the Sudanese gave him a passport. Hamid Mir, bin Laden's Pakistani biographer. Bin Laden pays a lot of respect to his mother. His mother tried her best to convince bin Laden that he should make a ceasefire with the Saudi regime. He should come back to Saudi Arabia. She went to see him in Sudan and she spent many days with him in Sudan. She was carrying a message of the Saudi King Fahd. At that stage, the differences between Osama bin Laden and the Saudi regime were entirely ego problems. No Islam, nothing. That was a problem between Prince Nayef, the Minister of the Interior, and bin Laden. They had some ego problems. Bin Laden had an objection. Why he shouts at me? And Nayef said, why he threatened me? So there was a problem between bin Laden and Prince Nayef. So his mother tried her best to calm down him. It was very difficult for her to understand that her son had a problem with Nayef. Now he is speaking against the king. He never spoke against the king in the past. Why he is speaking against the royal family? So he was going through a transformation period in those days, and he said sorry to his mother. Sorry, I'm not going to announce a ceasefire with the royal family, he said. I'm going to oppose them. Mohammed Atef, Al-Qaeda's military commander, told me that Sheikh bin Laden have lot of respect for the women. There is a misconception that we don't have any soft corner for the women. He said that Sheikh bin Laden, he is always very, very careful for his mother and he is in constant touch with his mother. He said, I was present in that meeting in Khartoum. Sheikh bin Laden told his mother, I can sacrifice my life for you, but right now what you are talking to me is against Islam. I'm fighting against the enemies of Islam, and you want that I should announce a ceasefire with the enemies of Islam. And his mother said, okay, I will not repeat my demand again. Thank you very much. So, I think that Sheikh bin Laden was successful in convincing his mother that you should not interfere in my ideological affairs. And his mother went back, and she informed the Saudi authorities. And after that, they announced they cancelled his citizenship. Abdelbari Atwan, the editor of Al-Quds Al-Arabi newspaper, who interviewed bin Laden in Afghanistan in November 1996. He loves his mother. You really can't imagine how he admires her. And even he loves his stepfather, whose family name is Atas. He's a businessman in Jeddah, so usually in our culture we don't like our stepfather, but he liked him a lot. And he said, the Saudi government sent me my mother and my stepfather to see me in Sudan. The offer, as he told me, is the Saudis have frozen his share of the business in a bank account in Saudi Arabia. And he told me there were about $200 million in that account and they promised to double it if he comes back. And it's just on one condition, to say that Saudi government is applying the Sharia, rule of Islamic law. He turned that down. Osama bin Laden. They sent me my mother, my uncle, and my brothers in almost 9 visits to Khartoum, asking me to stop and return to Arabia to apologize to King Fahd. I apologized to my family, kindly, because I know that they were driven by force to come to talk to me. I refused to go back. My family conveyed the Saudi government's message that if I did not go back, they'll freeze all my assets, deprive me of my citizenship, my passport, and my Saudi ID, and distort my picture in the Saudi and foreign media. They think that a Muslim may bargain on his religion. I said to them, "Do whatever you may wish. It is with Allah's bounty we refuse to go back. We are living in dignity and honor, for which we thank Allah. It is much better for us to live under a tree here on these mountains than to live in palaces in the most sacred land to Allah." In April 1994, the Saudi government officially stripped bin Laden of his citizenship. The same month, Bakr Mohammed bin Laden, the head of the bin Laden family and a half-brother to Osama bin Laden, issued the following statement to the Saudi press. "On behalf of all members of the family, we express regret, denunciation, and condemnation of all acts that Osama bin Laden may have committed." The information that follows was gathered from the Saudi bin Laden Group's website before it was taken off the internet after September 11, 2001. It gives you a snapshot of the diversity and extent of the bin Laden holdings around the time that bin Laden was cut off financially from his extended family. Infrastructure. SBG, Saudi bin Laden Group, has played a key role in building the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia's infrastructure, actively participating in successive government development programs. The company's infrastructure projects include highways, expressways, bridges, flyovers, tunnels and underpasses built to link the two holy cities of Mecca and Medina with the rest of the kingdom and neighboring countries. To date, roads built by SBG number in the thousands of kilometers. SBG's skills in infrastructure have been recognized and utilized in the United Arab Emirates, Jordan, Yemen, and Sudan. SBG's impressive list of achievements includes construction of desalination plants, water storage reservoirs, and one of the longest freshwater pipelines in existence. In the process of executing such heavy construction, SBG has built up one of the largest fleets of heavy equipment and tunneling drills in the world. Public buildings and airports. Over the years, the division has undertaken various challenging projects, large and medium scale, including complete airports and roads, hospitals and university complexes, housing facilities on a turnkey basis, including all civil electromechanical work for the Prophet's Mosque in Medina, Armed Forces Hospital Extension in Riyadh, Port Sudan Airport, and the Al Musa Tower in Dubai. Trading Division. SBG is active throughout the Middle and Far East in the operation of large franchise ventures in the fields of food and catering. For example, the distribution of Snapple drink and the distribution operations for companies like York International Corporation, Nortel, Schrader SA, Landis & Gear, Audi, Porsche, and Volkswagen. The flagship of SBG's trading activities is Mimar Trading Group, with its headquarters in Beirut. Mimar is a company operating in Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, Egypt, Lebanon, Syria, Turkey, France, Malaysia, Hong Kong, and Singapore. Lucenkersh, too, is the Al-Qaeda member who testified as a U.S. government witness in the 2001 trial of four men accused of a role in attacking two U.S. embassies in Africa in 1998. Excerpts of his testimony follow, outlining how bin Laden's funding dried up as a result of the Saudi government freezing his assets in 1994. Kershtu also explains that the Sudanese government started putting pressure on Arab militants living in the country. "There was a pressure from the Libyan government on the Sudanese government that all the Libyans must leave the country, and they informed Osama bin Laden that if you have some Libyans, you have to let them get out from the country. And Osama bin Laden informed these guys, 'You have to leave, because if you don't leave, you will be responsible for yourselves, and if somebody is caught, I am not responsible. What I can do for you is I can give you $2,400, plus a ticket with you and your wife if you want to live somewhere. But the Libyans, most of them, they refused the offer of Osama bin Laden. They were very upset and angry because he couldn't protect them, and they had a meeting. At the end of the meeting, they gave a letter to Osama bin Laden that they are leaving Al-Qaeda, and they took money and tickets, and some of them, they left. Some of them, they joined the Libyan Islamic group. Since the end of 94-95, we have a crisis in Al-Qaeda. Osama bin Laden himself, he was talking to us and saying he lost all his money, and he reduced the salary of people. And myself, when I wanted to go to renew my flying license in Kenya, he told me, just forget about it. In December 95, my wife was pregnant, and she has C-section, so I booked in the hospital in Khartoum, and I needed money for the hospital. It was $500, I think. And I asked Sheikh Said El-Masri, I asked him if he can give me some money. At that time, Osama bin Laden was in one of his projects in Kassala, another city in the Sudan. Sheikh Said El-Masri told me, there is no money, we can't give you anything, and why you don't take your wife to the Muslim hospital? I knew that if I take my wife there, she will die the first day. And I told him, if it was your wife or your daughter, you would take her there? I tell him, listen, why don't you borrow money for me and I will give money back to you? He said, I can't do anything until bin Laden come back. If I had a gun, I would shoot him at that time. Jamal al-Fadl, an early member of Al-Qaeda. What I tell bin Laden, some people complain because some people, they got high salary, some people, they got a little, and they want to know, if we are all Al-Qaeda membership, why somebody got more than others? Bin Laden say some people, they traveling a lot and they do more work. Some people, they got citizenship from another country, and if they go back over there for regular life, they can make more money than in group. And he says that's why he tried to make them happy and give them more money. I stole from bin Laden $110,000. When I find they know I take the money, I tell them yes. I pay around between $25,000 to $30,000 back. Bin Laden told me, I don't care about the money, but I care about you because you start this from the beginning. He said, you work hard in Afghanistan. You are one of the best people in Al-Qaeda group. We give you everything. When you travel, we give you extra money. We pay your medical bill. Why you did that? I tell him, the reason we talk about before. The Egyptian people, they got a lot of money. They got more salary than other. And we told you, some people, they joined the Al-Qaeda only a few years ago, and we started the Al-Qaeda. And why they got higher salary? He said, there's no reason for you to do that. If you need money, you should come speak with me and told me I want to buy house. I want to change my car. And you didn't do that. You just stole the money. And he say, there's no forgiveness until you bring all the money back. I tell him, but there's no money left. And he say, I can't forgive you until you give all the money. After that, I feel like I have to leave the group. There is no hope, and I think to leave Sudan. In 1996, I went to the American embassy, and I went to the visa line. The person asked me, do you want visa? I tell him, no, I don't want visa, but I have information about people they want to do something against your government. And he went inside, and 20 minutes later, a lady opens the door and she points to me and tells me, come inside. And she took me inside the room and she told me, what kind of information? I told her, I was in Afghanistan and I work with group and I know, in fact, those people, they try to make war against your country and they train very hard. And she tell me, what kind of war? I tell her, I don't know. Maybe they try to do something inside United States. And she tell me, how you know that? She give a lot of questions and she tell, I need you to answer these questions and when you finish, I need you to focus what you believe and what you know, what the group they're going to do exactly to our government. Al-Fadl's walk-in to a U.S. embassy would be a critical break for the CIA and FBI, the first time someone inside Al-Qaeda could describe the inner workings of the organization. In 1996, the Sudanese government was coming under increasing pressure from the governments of Egypt, the United States, and Saudi Arabia to rein in or expel bin Laden. Prince Turki Al-Faisal, the head of Saudi intelligence at the time. We monitored bin Laden recruiting persons from different parts of the Islamic world, from Algeria to Egypt, from East Asia to Somalia, to get them trained at these Sudanese camps. It was an unacceptable activity. So remarks were made, and the Sudanese authorities were informed, and we were given assurances that Osama would not be allowed to harm Saudi interests. Sudanese President Bashir asked for guarantees regarding bin Laden's prosecution if he were handed over to us, that he would not be tried by any legal authority in the Saudi kingdom. Bashir was told that no one is above the law and that we could not give such guarantees, and we rejected this offer. Abu Jandal, the Yemeni bodyguard of bin Laden's and close confidant of al-Qaeda's leader. The Sudanese were, until the very last moment, when bin Laden left Sudan, giving him the best treatment. His leaving Sudan was due to his political impact on the Saudi street through his effective speeches and statements. That led Riyadh, the Saudi capital, to pressure Khartoum to expel him from their country. Simultaneously, there were other Egyptian pressures which went along with the American pressure on Sudan. So the ruling Islamic Front in Sudan, under the leadership of Dr. Hassan al-Turabi, asked Sheikh Osama to leave the country. For bin Laden, Turabi was always a nuisance. Al-Turabi himself exerted a great deal of pressure on Sheikh Osama to make him leave Sudan. He visited him for 3 consecutive days, holding long meetings and heated discussions with him until late at night, to convince him to leave Sudan. Sheikh Osama tried to convince him of the opposite, that there was no need to expel him, that he had not committed any armed acts against Sudan, and that there was no other country ready to receive his men. But al-Turabi told him that he had 2 options. Either keep silent or he leave the country. That was when Sheikh Osama decided to leave Sudan. He made arrangements with the Sudanese to leave the country with his followers and moved to Afghanistan. Khaled Batarfi, bin Laden's childhood friend in Saudi Arabia. There was pressure on Sudan, and finally the Sudanese kicked him out, and then they took over his properties. From what I hear from his family, they took almost everything without compensation.
Ibrahim al-Sanusi, assistant to Sudan's then leader, Hussein Turabi.
One day Osama came to me and he told me that the government told him to leave the Sudan. I said to him not to leave. Then he came and said to me farewell, and that was the last time I saw him. Later on, I found out Ali Osman Taha, at that time the Sudanese Minister of Foreign Affairs, invited U.S. Ambassador Timothy Carney to his house for a dinner, and he told him, "We can give you Osama bin Laden." Carney said, "Let me consult Washington." And after a month or more, he came and said, "They had no legal charges filed against him, so we don't want him."
Ambassador Timothy Carney, the former U.S. envoy to Sudan, responds, "At no time did any Sudanese, Ali Osman Taha, the foreign minister of Sudan, or anyone else, ever say to me that they could give the U.S. Osama bin Laden. Taha and I talked about sending him back to Saudi Arabia in a mid-January 1996 chat. This was before that early February dinner at Taha's. No offer to give bin Laden to the U.S. figured there either."
Indeed, the 9/11 Commission concluded that the Sudanese government had not offered to hand over bin Laden to the United States, and that in any event, it would have been a futile gesture, as during the spring of 1996, there was no legal basis to hold bin Laden as he had yet to be indicted for any crime. Here is how the 9/11 Commission report describes this episode. In late 1995, when bin Laden was still in Sudan, the State Department and the CIA learned that Sudanese officials were discussing with the Saudi government the possibility of expelling bin Laden. U.S. Ambassador Timothy Carney encouraged the Sudanese to pursue this course. The Saudis, however, did not want bin Laden, giving as their reason their revocation of his citizenship. Sudan's Minister of Defense, Fatih Erwa, has claimed that Sudan offered to hand bin Laden over to the United States. The commission has found no credible evidence that this was so. Ambassador Carney had instructions only to push the Sudanese to expel bin Laden. Ambassador Carney had no legal basis to ask for more from the Sudanese since, at the time, there was no indictment outstanding.
Fahid Mojeh held several posts in various divisions of the Afghan Foreign Affairs Ministry between 1995 and the fall of the Taliban in 2001. Here, he describes how bin Laden engineered his departure from Sudan.
Some members of the Hizb-e-Islami, led by Yunis Khalis, an Afghan faction, went to Sudan in 96 and made bin Laden the offer to go to Afghanistan. Two planes left Afghanistan for Sharjah, a tiny emirate in the United Arab Emirates, to bring bin Laden. One plane went to Khartoum and returned for an overnight stay in Sharjah. Bin Laden was on board. The next day he got off one plane and boarded the other plane. One decoy plane went to Kabul and the other carrying bin Laden went to Jalalabad. At that time, Jalalabad was controlled by Haji Qadir of the Khalis faction, who treated him as an honored guest. The Americans contacted Haji Qadir in order to get hold of bin Laden, but at that time the Taliban were speeding towards Jalalabad, which they seized on July 26, 1996, and then bin Laden joined up with the Taliban.
Abu Jandal.
Bin Laden left Sudan for Jalalabad, Afghanistan, on a private jet. On board there was only a Russian pilot who spoke no Arabic. Bin Laden was also accompanied by two of his sons, Saad and Omar. There were also very few guards with him in the small plane, which held only 12 passengers. Brother Saif Adel, an Egyptian former Special Forces officer who would become Al-Qaeda's military commander in 2003, was sitting next to the pilot. In his hands, he held a map of the route because they did not trust the pilot very much. The departure was kept highly secret, and the security measures were very important for the success of bin Laden's departure for Afghanistan. His arrival in Afghanistan was coordinated with the field leader in Jalalabad, Engineer Mahmoud, a leader of the Hizb-e-Islami, the Afghan faction which controlled Jalalabad. They welcomed Sheikh Osama there because they both were former acquaintances. They gave him a warm welcome and then accompanied him to the headquarters of the Afghan leader, Mullah Yunus Khalis. That reception was a kind of payment for Sheikh Osama for everything he had offered the Afghan warriors.